Club. Driving. No purchase necessary.
You're listening to Radio Free. Radio Free Urbanism.
Hello and welcome back to Radio Free Urbanism, a podcast about urbanism and stuff. And I'm here with a very special guest who I've been admiring for quite a while about advocacy for cycling infrastructure in Vancouver. And that is Lucy Maloney. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's great to be with you.
So we got a lot of things to talk about. We're going to be talking about the political climate in Vancouver around bicycling infrastructure and some of the negative things we've had to deal with in the past couple of years. But it definitely has reinvigorated the passion the city has for the infrastructure we have and the direction we were heading in the past. But before we get into those details, let the audience know, who is Lucy Maloney?
Well, I am a freshly minted Canadian, but also still an Australian. So I'm a dual citizen. I have been traveling around the world with my family for quite a few years, but I started in Melbourne, Australia. So I started off as a lawyer. I worked as an in-house lawyer at the Victorian Environment Protection Authority in Melbourne for about a decade before I started roaming the globe. I've lived in Western Australia, where I worked for a mining company for a few years. I've lived in Singapore for a couple of years and Santiago, Chile, and now I've been in Vancouver for about 6 years.
Okay, so we've been in Vancouver for about the same time, I think. I've been here for almost 7 years now. And it's been life-changing for me in a lot of ways, just because when I first moved here, I was from Eastern Canada in London, Ontario, which has kind of become a meme in the whole urbanist space from Not Just Bikes, because Jason is also from there. So my mindset on the urban space has been completely transformed living here for the past 7 years now, where my wife is talking about moving back to Ontario. And I'm like, okay, but there's only very specific places I'm willing to go to now, as opposed to the past. But I'm curious, did you have the same experience, or were you interested in advocacy before you moved to Vancouver?
You know, it's sort of been a gradual thing for me. I have been a bike commuter ever since I was in elementary school. So I've always got around by bike. And so that necessarily involved getting struck by drivers a number of times and doored and inhaling fumes and swapping between probably starting more as a what they call a vehicular cyclist, which is someone that acts like a car when they're on a bike. I did triathlons for quite a while at university, and then I think it was the process of moving around the world and seeing how different cities approach solving the same problems in such different ways, and my experiences as well, being a parent and trying to get around, especially Singapore with two very young children and outside a car, you know, with one child in a pram or a stroller, as you call it, and another child on my chest in a carrier, you know, and just not being able to find elevators to get up and down, having trouble getting up and down to subway stations, and noticing paths that are worn into the grass by pedestrians who don't want to take an inconvenient and circuitous route to where they're going. You know, just all these little experiences really added up to me becoming more aware of how our cities are designed. And, you know, in my law degree, I studied environmental law and planning law. So, you know, I am very lucky to have a good understanding of how government works and how courts work. And I always taken a lot of notice of what's happening in the news. So I'm very lucky to be really well equipped to act as an advocate now that I've got such strong opinions on how things should be organized.
Right. Okay, well, we'll lead off there with the advocacy, because I know you from Vision Zero Vancouver. You've become their unofficial spokesperson, right? So how did you get involved with Vision Zero Vancouver in the first place?
Well, it's funny. At the moment, I'm volunteering for, I've cut down to only four organizations that I'm volunteering for. I do have a certain amount of involvement with Hub Cycling. I really enjoy working with Hub Cycling's Vancouver UBC local committee, and I'm really good friends with Jeff Lee, who's the president of Hub. I adore him, and he's been a huge help to me. And he really coached me up when 5 years ago I had a meeting with him because I was so frustrated at the traffic situation around my kids' elementary school in the West End of Vancouver, and I was organising a petition with other parents to lobby the city to put in a bi-directional separated bike lane outside the school to try and provide some space for people who were wanting to cycle to school. So that's how I got involved with Hub Cycling. I also have just been appointed as the working group lead for the DPAC, District Parent Advisory Council Working Group on Safe Routes and Active Transport. So that's kind of work that I've always been doing with schools, but now I've got a title to hang my work on, and I really love working with the people on that committee as well. I'm also working with, so at Hub Cycling, DPAC, Love the Lane, which is my little organisation with a couple of other people that got formed in response to the ABC supermajority sweeping into power in the last municipal election. And immediately, the day after the election happened, announcing widely that they were going to rip out the Stanley Park separated bike lane and put a new one in by summer 2023, vastly improved.
What's the date right now, though? Hold on.
Yeah.
Wait a minute.
Yeah, then it was 2024, and it's looking worse and worse as time goes past. But so that's when the work that I'm doing, especially the media work, really ramped up, because it's such a culture war. It's such a divisive political issue that's been quite openly used by a couple of park board commissioners in the lead up to the municipal election, quite unsuccessfully, I'd like to point out.
Right.
But they did a lot of damage in the process of their electioneering, unfortunately. Because it was so controversial, I started speaking to the media about it, and got, unfortunately, a great deal of experience. And that has ended up with me being kind of the spokesperson of last resort for Vision Zero Vancouver. And that's how I kind of got involved in Vision Zero Vancouver. But now I'm getting more and more involved, because I'm a huge admirer of the people that are involved in Vision Zero Vancouver. I think their work's amazing, but I also really enjoy working with them. You know, we've got a lot of shared goals and shared ideas about what needs to be done. And I love kind of, I'm at least a decade older than most of the other people in Vision Zero Vancouver, and I've got a lot of life experience and work experience, and I guess some rather useful academic qualifications and media experience. So I'm really enjoying kind of trying to coach people up and kind of mentor them. I mean, they probably don't see me as a mentor, but I'm just trying to get people experience in what I know how to do and help guide them along and build capacity so that we've got a really great bunch of people working on this stuff together and supporting each other, especially when things are a bit disappointing the way they can be. I've had gut punch after gut punch with decisions that have been made since the last municipal election, and learning how to brush yourself off and put a smile on your face and work constructively with elected officials and party members and other advocates and bring the public along with you can sometimes require a little bit of psychological support from from your support group, from your friends, and that's helped me so much.
Absolutely, I totally agree. I found the same thing, but finding a community, even if it's online, is super helpful. But then again, myself getting, you know, just on the surface level, getting involved with Vision Zero Vancouver, I'm still very new to the organization. My most involvement has been placing stickers around town and helping them film the viral brick video. And that's most of what I've done for Vision Zero Vancouver. But just having that group so I can poke my head in, see what's going on in the Discord, and, you know, occasionally adding what I have to say or frustrations that I have is really helpful to have. But I want to go back to Love the Lane. Is it simply just a soapbox that you've built for yourself that you can advocate from?
It kind of is, but it's also a little support group in itself, because I'm not the only one in Love the Lane, but I'm not going to reveal who else is in there with me. But, you know, we specialize particularly in Stanley Park and Beach Avenue, but I get a lot of my any compliments I get about my media performances are really a team effort of all the people in the groups that I volunteer with, sharing information and insights, especially when we've got a bit of notice of a media opportunity. But also there's a media professional who gives me very who's really trained me how to deal with the media. And that person has counseled me to always thank my journalists. We draft media releases together. We sometimes just send little messages or emails to journalists saying this is coming up. He has helped me to present myself better, to, you know, look at the outcome of what comes out the other end, and so feed in better quality inputs so that our messages get across. You know, when we started Love the Lane, we organised one protest ride, and I don't know if you heard about what happened, but it was just on the coldest, wettest day. Most people that attended have forgiven me for the hypothermia, but, you know, I had before then organised some protest rides in Stanley Park to support keeping the bike lane and getting it back when it was taken out and put in a couple of times. But the goal of those things was to get media attention, to give media pictures and to get them to pay attention to our side of why having a separated bike lane in on Stanley Park Drive is such a wonderful thing, because obviously the our enemies were getting plenty of media attention on their mythical reasons, not based on fact, as to why you shouldn't have a bike lane. So, but once we started to get to know the journalists and they knew to call on me if they got anything to do with Beach Avenue or Stanley Park or the seawall in general or active transport in general, I started getting calls without having to organise protest rides. And that's so good, because organising protest rides takes a lot of effort. It's really stressful because you're responsible for people's safety and for enough people getting there and what time it happens and making sure the media get there. So if you can get media attention and get your messages across without having to organise a media event, you know, it's so much more efficient. Like today I did a media interview with a journalist from City News, and I got a call this morning half an hour before we met outside the Sylvia Hotel. I rode my e-bike down Beach Avenue bikeway. You know, it's not a big time commitment for me now, so I can get a lot more bang for my buck just speaking to the media without all the pre-work. So, yeah, it's worked out well, because although we can do a lot with social media, the conventional mainstream media is a very effective way of reaching people who haven't been exposed to our views on how the world should be organised. And it's good to be able to just again and again and again give people a fresh view of how their city could be organised to benefit us all more.
Right, because we definitely build these bubbles for ourselves online. We have these communities, again, like we just talked about, where we share the same opinions. And one of my favorite social media platforms is Reddit. And just my curated page is going to be very much geared towards the things that I'm interested in. And I'm going to be exposed to those things over and over. So yeah, I could definitely see how going to traditional media would be much more beneficial to spreading the message. And it's definitely something that I'm seeing more and more is people who aren't really interested in this type of thing. They don't really care. They just go about their day. They're learning about it. I'm having people talk to me about it because they know I'm interested in it. And they're telling me they've heard about one thing or another. I think, again, the brick thing was massive. It was crazy. Like,
yeah,
my mother-in-law emailed my wife, was like, hey, I heard they're handing out bricks to cross the street in Vancouver now. Like,
yeah, that's
in Ontario. Yeah.
And, it gives us an opportunity to start a really productive conversation about how dangerous it is to cross the road and the power imbalance between drivers and people outside cars. And should we be prioritising cars and driving the whole time like society tells you to, or could we organise things a different way so that people had alternatives? And what are the benefits of having alternatives, you know, for people who are beyond driving age or can't afford a car or too young, too old, disabled in a way that precludes them from driving a car? You know, it's a fantastic conversation to have. I had an experience like that last night. My son is doing bike racing. He's a baby roadie, and I took him to his cycle training last night, and one of his coaches, we were talking about one of our mutual acquaintances who was crashed into and is in a really serious condition. And I was asking after his recovery and if there'd been any more news about his recovery. And, you know, we talked about what we can do to avoid crashes. I mean, I'm terrified. My kid rides up and down Arbutus Greenway and adjacent routes, given the disruptions at the moment, to and from school each day, and is a very, very obsessed road cyclist. And all I can think about is, wow, I hope I've done enough work to stop him from getting killed. It's very serious for us.
That is, yeah, it's very sad to think about that imbalance that we have on the streets. So while we're on this topic, I want to ask you about that, because there is this junction, and I don't think a lot of people really grok this, and it's that road safety is a social justice issue.
Yeah.
So can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, it is a huge social justice issue because, you know, there is a reason why our city, our society is organized to benefit people who use cars to drive to and from wherever they're going. I mean, it started decades ago when the decision makers in cities you know, at every level of politics were, you know, men with stay-at-home wives probably and children that they didn't look after as a primary carer, and they wanted to have a convenient and pleasant drive to and from work and a pleasant weekend activity where you could go for a drive with your family. I mean, that's a massive generalisation, but, you know, when we look at who has the time to attend council meetings and speak, who has time to, who's in power to make decisions, it's the powerful people in society who have a voice, and that's usually people who can afford to own and drive a car. So people who are too young or too old or too poor or are disabled in a way that precludes them from owning or driving a car are not the powerful people who make the decisions. So, you know, I am an anomaly. I am not in paid employment. I spend all my free time pretty much being an active transport advocate. And I'm motivated by, you know, originally by my interest in the environment and climate change. But, you know, it's me and a whole bunch of people 20 years older than me at the park board offices and at City Hall speaking in person. And that's not a great situation for having a say. So the people who are least able to have time to contribute to civic dialogue are missing out. You know, parents are too busy. Parents of young children are too busy. This, you know, the West End Waterfront Plan had a whole bunch of stuff in it that would have been great for parents and kids and teenagers, young people, the skate park, the splash pad, more places to hang out, which we call third places. You know, kids who are underage can't go and hang out at a pub with their friends and catch up, or, you know, go out to an expensive restaurant. They need free places to hang out. And I guess the West End Waterfront decision that's just happened is at just such a microcosm of this exact phenomenon, because the thing that got approved by council was the thing that benefits adult drivers and business people, the powerful people in society, and all the other bits of the plan were discarded.
Right, exactly. And that's a topic I want to get onto. And since you just drove us there, let's take, well, sorry, you rode us there. We didn't drive. We'll run with it. So this is the latest in the running ABC issues that people like us are very displeased with. So let's go right there to the Beach Avenue bike lane. I mentioned it on the regular podcast past couple of weeks, but just in passing, because I knew I was going to be talking to you and I thought we'd have lots of time to talk about it. So yeah, just go from the start, if you can, from your perspective, and tell us what the Beach Avenue plan was and what direction are we heading into now?
Well, I'm going to take you all the way back to the beginning of the pandemic. I can't tell you how excited I was, like just literally going squee when in the midst of this horror of the beginning of the pandemic, where we were all terrified and didn't know what was ahead for us, the council started laying out orange cones along Beach Avenue, and I'm bailing them up and saying, what's going on, you know? And they said, oh, well, we're going to have Stanley Park closed to cars and Beach Avenue is going to have this separated bike lane, albeit by orange cones. And it just it gave me such a mood lift, and especially my children were obviously quite a deal younger then, and it really just gave us something monumental to do during the pandemic when schools were closed and, you know, you had so many restrictions. I spent that whole first summer with my daughter and her friend and her friend's dad, and we'd take turns doing laps of Stanley Park on our bikes while our children played at Brockton Point, which was closed to cars even when, after 2 months of the pandemic, the separated bike lane was put through and drivers were given one lane back to be able to access the park in motor vehicles. So it was so brilliant because there were no cars driving around Brockton Point, and our small children were playing hide and seek in the trees and just hanging out on the road, and massive groups of cyclists with families, with kids in trailers, were just riding around and stopping and enjoying themselves and making the most of this terrible situation that we were in with the pandemic. And it was an absolute joy, and it really opened up a lot of people's eyes as to what was possible. So that was what started it all. Beach Avenue then, a couple of years later, marvellously got some concrete curbs. It got made. It was still temporary, according to the council's classification. And people don't understand that although concrete curbs were laid by the infamous curb pooper that I tweeted all about for, you know, incessantly for a while, it was still a temporary configuration. And council wasn't required to reallocate that street space. That was a staff decision, and staff were able to make that decision. And the West End Waterfront Plan was the decision was made in the West End Waterfront Plan to make Beach Avenue Bikeway permanent, but as part of the park redevelopment in stages. So the Aquatic Centre has to be rebuilt because it's not seismically safe and it's falling apart. But I think due to our advocacy and just people's incredible love for Beach Avenue Bikeway and the thousands and thousands of bike trips every day during summer that take place, I mean, it's Vancouver's most popular, well-used bike lane and one of the most used bike lanes in the whole of North America. I think when the West End Waterfront Plan was being developed, staff realised that there was no way we were getting rid of Beach Avenue Bikeway because it's just too popular, and there would be public outrage. So, and I think that this has confused a lot of people who dislike me and my advocacy because they're like, well, Beach Avenue Bikeway is being made permanent, so what's your problem? But they don't realise that my interests are broader than just what's good for bikes and cycling. So I'm also really interested, and that's why I'm part of Vision Zero Vancouver, in people not being killed by drivers. And
it's probably a good thing, yeah.
Yeah, organising our streets so that people don't get hit by drivers as often, so we reach Vision Zero. I'm also really interested in children's welfare and social justice issues for older people who can't drive a car, you know, and the facilities and the public space we need for kids and young people to hang out. And you know, we all are hearing about how terrible kids' mental health is now and young people's mental health, and people are blaming devices. But, you know, we as a society get very angry if children are noisy, and we also absolutely abjectly fail to allocate public funding to creating facilities for children's recreation and third places. So I don't know. We have to start directing some public funds to looking after kids and getting them places outdoors where they can do all the things that people say are good for them, know are good for them. But clearly we're spending $480 to $580 million on one sporting event in a couple of years, but $300 million for the West End Waterfront Plan is a bridge too far. And, you know, we were at a meeting at City Hall yesterday morning, and we're trying to explain about traffic calming infrastructure that can be done really, really cheaply. You know, you don't have to do concrete, laying concrete curbs is expensive, but you could do flex posts with paint or pot plants or concrete jersey barriers. You know, we're scrounging for a few cents for active transport and traffic calming infrastructure, and yet these wild sums get allocated to highway widening and sports events and major events, and the police budget, which is about $1.2 million a day for the VPD alone. You know,
it seems to be a recurring thing
even questioning.
Yeah. It seems to be a recurring thing when it comes to all of these policy decisions, and they say, oh, we can't afford that. Or I think the mayor said something like, this isn't La La Land when it came to one of the decisions in the past. That was what happened with the Broadway bike lane that they were going to add. They said, oh, it's going to be too expensive to add it to the plans at this stage. whatever the cost was, it was $10 to $20 million or something like that mm-hmm. to re-engineer it. Too much money, right? Same thing when we talk about safety cameras. They think it's going to cost too much, even though when you do the math, anyway, I can't get into that right now.
You know what? Jeff Lee, who's president of Hub, told me a great story about when the Point Grey Road bike route was being created.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was talking to, I think, one of the councillors about how much it cost. And I think it cost, I can't remember, I might be wrong, but something in the order of $3 to $6 million, including the pedestrian infrastructure. Okay. And so Jeff told me that at the same time they were justifying that, he was citing the cost of one left turn slip lane that cost that amount for 200 meters of road.
Oh. That is unbelievable.
Yeah. So
not only do we have that going on, but they spent part of the active transportation budget to take out the Stanley Park bike lane.
Yeah. Oh, and boy. The school's active travel unit has an annual budget of $750,000 a year. And the mayor's office has an annual budget of over $1 million a year. I think $1.2 or $1.3 million a year. So, you know, we're just not it's very clear where our priorities lie. And I think Brent Totteran said, if you want to see a city's priorities, you've got to look at their budget. And that's why I think as advocates, we need to concentrate really hard on advocating for a better share as part of the city budget. But we don't want it to come from other good social programs. We obviously want it to come from harmful things that are contributing to deaths and injuries on our roads and stopping people from feeling safe enough to use active travel to get to and from their work and school and wherever else they're going.
Yeah, I wonder if they decided to make an equitable budget so that the percentage of people, the modal share of people on whatever mode, that's the amount of money that went to that. I think it would just happen where, you know, micromobility would just keep increasing, because that is a lot of money, whatever it is, 2 to 7% modal share in Vancouver, that much money would just keep growing because it would, the infrastructure would just flourish. It'd be wild.
Yeah. And so, and there's the whole, you don't build a bridge based on how many people are swimming across the river factor, right?
Yeah.
Which is build it and they will come, to throw out all these other cliches. You know, the more connected and convenient we make the active transport network, including footpaths or sidewalks, the more people are going to use it and have that as a choice. You know, no one's asking people to give up their cars. My family has a car and I drive, you know, as little as possible, obviously, but, you know, It's about giving people a choice.
Yeah. Build it and they will ride. So on that note, build it and they will drive. So back to the Beach Avenue bike lane.
Yeah.
That is what is going to happen, at least in my estimation. So let's go back to the Beach Avenue bike lane and talk about the decision that was made last week.
Yes. Well, I actually should have realized something was up, because the two remaining, there are three remaining ABC Park Board commissioners, and two of them voted when the Park Board voted on the West End Waterfront project not to support it, right? And they gave unclear reasons, right? I think Commissioner Verdi talked about needing more information or something, rather than clearly objecting to the whole plan. But I didn't pick up on that, probably because it was very late at night. But as it turns out, the West End Waterfront Plan has been caught up in the beef between the Park Board and the council. So, I mean, you know, no one's going to say that out loud, but it's very obvious that if this if we had the three independent Park Board commissioners voting in line with and being members of ABC still, I think we would have had a very different outcome on this. So I suspect it's partially the abolish the park board situation, but it's also partially probably that the World Cup is over budget and maybe they don't want to raise property taxes. But it was a 30-year plan, the West End Waterfront plan. You know, nothing was going to happen straight away. So you can only speculate, but definitely abolish the park board, I think, had a pretty big contribution to this failing at council.
Absolutely. So the failing at council was basically canceling almost the entire plan, right? Yeah. Except for one thing. So what was that one thing?
Well, the West End Waterfront plan was separated up into stages. And so the only thing that got approved was stage one, which is the reinstating of two-way traffic on Beach Avenue west of Denman, and the installing of a curbside parking lane as well, moving Beach Avenue bikeway over to where the current sidewalk and old seawall bike path are, right? And then there's a row of trees, and then there's going to be a pedestrian pathway where the dirt path is currently worn into the grass. Now, the fact that there's a dirt pathway worn into the grass by the absolutely heaps of pedestrians that are down there all through the year, but especially over summer, gives you a bit of an idea of how we should be allocating a massive amount of space to pedestrians rather than giving pedestrians less space and allocating, basically tripling the space that's currently available to the movement and storage of motor vehicles, which is one lane for moving cars.
Yeah. So Councillor Meisner sent out a tweet a little while ago, and he detailed that in a photo that they shared where it showed the three lanes, the bike lane that would be basically where it used to be, and then a new pathway that's beyond the trees closer to the beach side, right? And what he said was they're restoring two-way traffic, allowing for future transit, new separated AAA bike lane, new pedestrian pathway on the south side, and then the key here, a win for everyone, which I think I can vehemently disagree with, that that is a win for everyone. And the biggest reason is because when we talk about induced demand, that's exactly what will happen when they reinstate the two-way. People coming in from the park, from the North Shore, it gives them an extra way to get into the city and to filter cars into the West End.
Yeah, it's definitely going to induce traffic along that stretch. And I think you're going to find that during peak times on nice days, you're just going to have a big lineup of drivers going both ways on that road, looking for parking places. And when it's not busy, you're going to see much higher speeds because those lanes are going to be wider to accommodate future transit, as they keep saying, even though there's very little prospect of TransLink having the resources or will to put transit in there. So you're going to have wider lanes and two-way. So you're going to see higher speeds along there because you're not going to see automated enforcement, which would be the only thing that would control speeds along there if every driver was getting a ticket for exceeding the 30-kilometer-an-hour speed limit.
Which, yeah, is a problem almost everywhere in the city. I got a speed gun a while ago, and I just bring it out for fun, just to see my own curiosity, actually find proof in what I feel when I'm out cycling or on my scooter or whatever, is that so many cars are speeding well beyond the speed limit. Often I've seen as much as 60 kilometers down our bikeways. It's pretty insane. And when we're talking about the major streets, it's even beyond that. I think right now on Broadway, many sections are 30 kilometers per hour. Now, this isn't a shared bike street or anything, but it's supposed to be 30 kilometers per hour. We know that's not happening. But yeah, to think about the induced demand in the West End is just, it's crazy. We think about the extra pollution, the increases in car accidents. From what I've heard is that this section specifically, the most westerly part, has seen a reduction in collisions compared to the rest of it.
Yeah. So since Beach Avenue Bikeway was installed, there has been a pretty massive reduction in crashes along Beach Avenue. But the one-way sections, so between Hornby Street and Jervis Street, so that first section that goes outside the Vancouver Aquatic Centre, and the section west of Denman that goes between Denman Street and Stanley Park, have seen the biggest reduction. So having one-way traffic means that fewer people crossing the road are being hit by drivers. Where it's two-way, speeds have reduced and crashes have reduced, but nowhere near to the extent of the one-way sections. So that's really depressing that, you know, the convenience of drivers is being prioritised over the physical safety of people outside cars. There's no doubt that more people are going to get hurt once there's two-way traffic there.
100%. Like, it seems no doubt that that's going to happen. It's just so unfortunate that we're going in this direction. It's just backpedaling, right? I'm hopeful that this is just a small pendulum swing the wrong direction to it pushes us to go the other way, because that's what we saw with critical mass, something that had relatively fizzled out because we were moving in the correct direction. And the Broadway plan, Xing the bike lane, kind of reinvigorated that, and also the Stanley Park bike lane. So I'm hopeful at least, but we'll see.
Well, yeah, I mean, the problem is that with this series of extremely significant decisions that take us backwards on active transport and road safety, for example, Broadway, ripping out the Stanley Park bike lane, modifying Councillor Boyle's speed camera and red light camera motion into a future study of some sort, and this West End waterfront plan, staff are getting the message, you know, and Donnie Rosa being disappearing from the park board. Not sure exactly what happened, but, you know, I think that a clear signal has been given to staff that they can't be too ambitious on this stuff. And what I'm deeply concerned about is that the next significant thing that's coming up, which is the Portside Greenway, of which the most important part is the direct route on Powell for 800 metres. It's only 800 metres. It's possible it should happen. But I am extremely concerned that staff are not even going to suggest that, because I feel like unless the ABC supermajority on council and the mayor's office directly asked them to recommend that, I think there's no way that it'll happen. Because imagine if you were a staff member who'd spent 3 or 4 years working on the West End waterfront project only to see it shelved, you know, or if you're senior staff on council and you don't want to be kind of in trouble or not supported in your work or lose your employment, you know, I think that you're going to be looking at the decisions that have been made since the municipal election, and you'll be sniffing the wind and trying to find things that are actually going to be supported by council.
That's rough. Yeah. That really put me down.
I mean, that's speculation on my part, and there's stuff we can do as advocates to try and anticipate that and intervene, right, and get support. And one of those things is something that's very important to me, which is fostering relationships with the majority council members and the mayor's office. And, you know, I get a little bit of flack for that, and I suppose it takes a special personality type to be able to brush myself off and put a smile on my face and, you know, and seek meetings and be friendly and explain stuff and not you know, yell at them when they make decisions that are very, very disappointing and upsetting to me. But, you know, we're working with the same people until the municipal election who have the capacity to make the decisions that we want, and they may well get re-elected for another 4 years after the next municipal election. So I guess for me the choice is between trying to get things done that are possible within the current constraints that we have, or just giving up and yelling, and I would prefer to kind of try and achieve some things, and the winds might blow more favorably at some time sooner rather than later.
Okay, well, there's the hope. There's the white pill. We can swallow that. We have at least have that much. We can claw something back. But I know we're definitely have some more defeats coming up in the near future. It feels inevitable at this point, but again.
Well, you know, I'm very hopeful. I'm always hopeful that there's something that I can do to persuade and to influence the people who are making the decisions. And I try very hard to do that. And to remain civil, even in the face of gut-punching decisions. And I know that that's not for everybody.
Yeah.
And I don't blame people for being very angry and upset and yelling and flipping tables. And honestly, at the moment, after being supremely unsuccessful at achieving pretty much anything other than getting my face on the TV to complain rather than complaining in the privacy of my own home, I'm wondering, you know, is my style of advocacy effective or useful? You know, when we saw parents in Amsterdam fighting in the streets and barricading streets and yelling, "Stop the Kindermord," the child murder, I mean, look at Amsterdam now. We should be doing what they're doing. Maybe we're not doing enough.
It's time for pitchforks.
Maybe we're being too polite.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I don't question anyone's alternative advocacy style or activist style at all, because, you know, things aren't going that well to achieve the things that we know are factually going to benefit society.
Yeah, and we're seeing more of that. I think there's a reactionary protest tomorrow, which, if you're listening to this, will be a couple of days ago, I think Friday the 17th at City Hall, a die-in, which is where people lay down with their bikes as, you know, a protest saying people are getting killed and it's going to continue happening until we change something. So it's about the prioritizing, again, like you said, of drivers and their convenience over the safety and lives of people outside of cars.
And it's not just, I mean, that's the most important thing, is that people are being killed and injured. And people inside cars are being killed and injured.
Yeah,
it's very bad. But there are other terrible effects, which are, for example, we know that it's good for children's development to roam their neighbourhoods. That's what I did when I was growing up. I would get on my bike and I would go to roam around to other kids' houses, and you could tell where people were by how many bikes were laying around outside people's houses. And I'd go and ring doorbells till I found someone to hang out with. And we actually developed a lot of skills as children doing that, because when we roam our neighborhood, we work on our risk evaluation and risk management skills, and having that autonomy to roam our neighborhoods by ourselves is something that gives us a lot of satisfaction and independence. So it's really tragic that we're creating and have created an environment where kids are indoors on devices, because that's where parents know that they're safe, and parents really resist letting their kids roam unaccompanied around their neighborhoods because of how dangerous it is to cross the road. And then you've got this negative feedback loop where people get driven to school because it's too dangerous to walk to school because of the cars, so they add another car.
Yeah, so this is like my passion right here, what you're getting into now. So the bike lanes, the big, beautiful bike lanes with the barriers, they get the headlines, right? Those are the things that people talk about when they get built. You look at it, oh, that's amazing. Or the waterfront trails like we have around Falls Creek. Those are the things that people come to see. But the things that I believe are the backbone of a good network is just safe neighborhood streets. And we have this perfect situation here in Vancouver where we have a grid pattern where we can make this work incredibly well for the people that live there and for the people, the active transport users moving through there. So I want to talk about that a little bit, and especially around schools. What do you think is missing in the bikeways that we have in Vancouver that could make them safer and more enjoyable?
I think that daylighting of intersections is crucially important, and removing on street car parking at least on one side of a bikeway. So I have a friend at Hub Cycling who calls the bike streets with parking down either side car canyons.
Car canyons. Right?
Car canyons. It's marvelously evocative term, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, and so the thing that we've actually asked for, Vision Zero Vancouver has been asking for, is the daylighting of intersections around schools and community centres and on the designated bike routes. And what that means is that instead of having cars parked right up to close to the intersection, you might put a Mobi bike station or a concrete jersey barrier or some physical impediment to stop people from parking so close to the intersection, right? And what that does is it gives people inside cars and outside cars better visibility, better sight lines of the intersection, so that you can see when pedestrians are coming and to slow down and to wait, and pedestrians can see when a car is coming. So you know how people are always complaining that that cyclist or that pedestrian jumped out in front of them? Well, that is cured by daylighting of intersections. We've also been talking to council about more bump outs. Councillor Lenny Joe has learned all about bump outs and is very pleased that he knows about those now, and talking about how our choice not to put speed humps or raised zebra crossings, which actually I'm going to try and remember the term for it. So continuous sidewalks rather than sidewalks that dip down to road level. Our choice not to put those on arterial roads it's not a hard and fast rule. It's a policy choice to prioritise the convenience of drivers over the physical safety of people, and especially school children who attend schools that are on arterials, like the West 16th Schools Zone, which has got Lord Byng Secondary and Queen Elizabeth and Ecole Jules Quesnel. Quesnel? I don't know. Anyway,
French is getting very good.
I apologise to any French speakers out there and the French people as a whole for my poor pronunciation. But so the council is resisting putting raised crosswalks or speed humps on 16th because it's an arterial. But council also could consider automated enforcement, because if every driver who exceeded the speed limit along there got a ticket, then pretty soon you'd find people not exceeding the speed limit. So it's got to be a combination of things. They can't just say no speed humps on arterials and then no automated enforcement, because police aren't there often enough to make any difference whatsoever.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a big difference when it comes to North America and in a lot of other places. We seem to be afraid of automated enforcement for some reason. So I know in Australia, I have a good friend here in Vancouver who's from Melbourne, actually, and he's talked a lot about that and in his experience. He's lived here for about 5 years now, and his experience is just how lax the police feel here compared to back home.
Yeah.
He always says that when he's either driving or he's on a bike or just watching the streetscape and seeing how things play out. And he found it strange. Obviously, he's used to it now, but can you talk about that, the differences we have here versus in Australia?
Different. Yeah, I try not to diss Vancouver compared to other cities that I've lived in, but there are no significant consequences for motorists breaking the law in Vancouver. It's terrible. It's very different from Melbourne, where I'm from. I had a Melburnian visitor come and tell me that they've reduced the speed limit in the central business district, the downtown of Melbourne, to 40 kilometres an hour. But the difference is that there is a speed camera and probably a red light camera on every single intersection through the central Melbourne downtown grid, right? But the difference is that here, I don't fully understand why, but very few people even get a ticket, and tickets aren't issued to people who exceed the speed limit by 5 kilometres or 10 kilometres. Tickets aren't issued until you're exceeding the speed limit by 20 to 40 kilometres an hour.
That's insane.
Which makes them entirely ineffective and makes designated speed limits a mere suggestion. It is unbelievable. So in Melbourne, apparently, I read in an article, the margin for error on a fixed speed camera is 2 kilometres an hour. And that means that if you have a posted speed limit of 40 kilometres an hour and you go 43 kilometres an hour, then you will get a ticket in the mail. Every driver, right?
That is wild.
What happens at every intersection through Melbourne. If you drive 45 kilometres an hour through the central business district of Melbourne, you can get multiple expensive speeding tickets. If it's a not fixed speed camera, like a speed camera that's mounted in a police officer's vehicle, the margin for error is a whopping 3 kilometres an hour.
Wow.
So you'd have to be going 44 kilometres an hour to get a ticket. And, you know, I like to consider that I'm a fairly conservative driver, and I do drive when I'm back in Melbourne. I haven't been back to Melbourne for about 5 years. But in the last 6 or 7 years, I got a ticket for driving through a light. I was driving to the airport in a hired car at 4 in the morning, and instead of putting on the brake to stop when a light went amber, I kept going through, and I got a ticket in the mail. And you get tickets for mobile or cell phone use, because they have cameras mounted, and if you have your mobile phone in your hand, you get a ticket. I mean, it's just a different world. In Melbourne, you know that you have to obey the road rules, or else it's highly likely that you'll get a ticket. And the booze buses, the enforcement of impaired driving, is also something that is a huge thing in Melbourne. You know, they have these big blitzes where they have the booze bus, which is this massive police vehicle where all drivers get stopped, and if you blow into the breathalyzer and you exceed the limit, you get taken into the booze bus. It's quite a thing. But here, I don't know.
They're pretty rare. I've ran into one once, maybe last year around Christmas time, and it was when we came over the Second Narrows and the Ironworkers, and I was driving, but I mean, I was the designated driver, so it was totally fine. Yep. And they gave me a gift card or something, but I'm sure they'd catch people, but I don't think it's that extensive where they're just driving around to downtown like that. We don't see that in Vancouver, like downtown. That's very rare, right?
So it's a very different culture. And I remember when I did a CKNW live interview when around the time that Councillor Boyle moved her motion to ask the province for more speed and red light cameras at particularly dangerous intersections. And I won't say the name of the radio host, but again and again and again was asking, is it a cash grab? Is it a cash grab? So if you have a automated enforcement and you are exceeding the speed limit by 20 kilometres an hour, is it a cash grab that you have to pay money?
It's insane. Like, that's just, it's almost unfathomable to think that's a cash grab.
And twice I explained it different ways during this live interview. And then as soon as they were asking for callers to call in, it was like, do you think this is a cash grab? Oh, my God. It's the most optional tax grab in the world. I'm surprised that more motorists aren't upset that more isn't being done to improve road safety, because the insurance costs, I mean, your insurance costs are going to go down if fewer people are crashing their cars. Yeah, and everybody knows somebody that's been killed or injured in a car crash.
Yeah. And you see complaining about it all the time is when you go on the subreddit, like the Vancouver subreddit, you see it all the time. People complaining about how bad the drivers are, people driving recklessly, yep. people driving through the streets, speeding at night with their, you know, loud exhausts and things like that. And we just don't seem to care. But I could see how someone might think it's a cash grab if it was like a pork barrel politics situation where it's a very low margin and all the money's going to the police force. But that's not the case. That's not what was offered up by Councillor Boyle. She was saying, we're going to put these in the most dangerous intersections in the city, and we're going to use that money to reinvest it in the street to make it safer.
Yeah.
So naturally, people won't speed anymore. They'll be safer. Oh, that's probably the one thing I was most gutted by with this council we have when the supermajority in ABC has been that just because of it just seems so logical. Like it all just made sense. It was like, this is a great idea. And I'm just still sad about it.
That was really regrettable. And I'm hoping that the ABC supermajority doesn't write off automated enforcement. I hope that they're going to consider automated enforcement for school streets the way that's what happens in London, where there's not physical infrastructure to close streets adjacent to schools. There is signage notifying motorists about the hours that school street operates, and then it's enforced by a camera. And so I hope that this council doesn't just write off the idea. I hope that we see automated enforcement considered around schools, especially on arterials, community centres, other public facilities on arterials. That's the perfect way. You know, if they're not going to put in raised crosswalks and speed humps on arterials, they need to use automated enforcement and far more strict automated enforcement than currently operates in Vancouver.
I wholeheartedly agree. We're getting long in the tooth here, but I have one last question, and I think it's probably the most important one in this space, at least from my perspective. And the urbanist community has been growing exponentially, and people have been getting interested. They're getting educated about this through different means. But a topic that's become hot as of late is actual advocacy. People are getting interested in advocacy, and they're also saying, hey, why aren't we advocating more? And I think that comes from just your personal responsibility and bravery to go do that. So I kind of did a deep dive in listening to a lot of the podcasts that you've been on over the years. And I saw how your way of explaining things has evolved. You become much more direct and concise about what you wanted to say. So my question is, what is some advice and wisdom you have to share with folks who are interested in advocacy?
I would definitely find your community, as you say. I have gotten so much better at it just by developing my contacts. And I mean, I really try and pass on any knowledge I have, and I try and recognise that people are a bit timid when they're dipping their toes in the water, and they might not know how to make a difference, or they might not know, you know, they might not feel ready to go to City Hall in person and speak to the councillors, or they might not feel confident to organise a meeting with a councillor at City Hall and ask them for things. You know, that's a gradual process, and that's one of the reasons why I was so thrilled to go to a meeting this week and take along five other Vision Zero Vancouver members, because everyone's got great ideas and they're super smart and motivated, and it's just nice to have them get used to how things work and how you approach things and how you try and achieve what you want to achieve. And you know, I've learnt so much, as I said, from Jeff Lee. And you know, one of the great things that has helped me a lot is to be able to like, after the terrible Stanley Park decision that I was so upset about, where they were considering three options for leaving parts of the bike lane in place, and we were hoping that they would leave 100% of the bike lane in place and gradually swap it out for a permanent configuration. But I thought it was realistic that we might get 70%. But we ended up getting like almost 0%. We got the worst possible option, and it was amended to make it even worse than we imagined. And so I'm sitting there at the park board next to one of my Twitter friends, who I won't mention who it was, and my brain literally stopped working. And we at Love the Lane had drafted up a couple of, like, three different media releases, but the one that dealt with the worst possible scenario we thought was so unrealistic, we hadn't actually spent a lot of time working on it. And my brain had short-circuited. It was late at night. So I had to actually say to my co-conspirator who was working on the media releases, I can't process it. But how I processed it, and I actually did a media interview later that night, was I spoke to Jeff Lee about it, and he talked me through it, and we talked together about what it meant, and, you know, what was good, what was bad, how we should approach talking about it. And another friend, because I'm an extrovert, I process things by talking them through. So I talked to two different really good mentors that night. I did a media interview for radio that I never even found, and I don't really remember who it was. I just got a phone call and said, oh, yeah, I can speak to you. But the next morning I did what I thought was one of my best media interviews on – it was a live television interview on Global. And I was so proud of that and so grateful to the people that I had spoken to just help me mentally work through it, so that I could not sound angry and emotional the next morning at my 6:45 television interview that I had to do. And I was able to reasonably interpret things for people and get all our key messages across about why it was a bad decision and what we wanted to see in the future, and sound reasonable and credible, so that the people watching that would see me as a persuasive person and listen to our key messages. And that only happened because of the support of the three different people, my Love the Lane person, my Twitter friend, and Jeff Lee, president of Hub, talking it through with me. So it is a team effort. So the tip I would give to people trying to get into advocacy is work to your own strengths, work out what you enjoy doing and what contributions you can make. Don't feel guilty about the lack of time. I mean, anyone that's working full time and looking after kids and trying to pay the rent and trying to stay healthy and mentally balanced, you know, don't be too hard on yourself. You can't spend anywhere near as much time on this stuff as someone like me can. I've got older children and I'm not in paid employment. So that's why, I'm very, very lucky to be able to be flexible with time and to be able to put a lot of time into this. So find your people and gradually get into it and read and listen to as much as you can.
That's awesome. I think I'm going to take some of that advice, because I think I'm hard on myself sometimes. So a lot of things I'm not very good at, like just having a conversation with somebody who disagrees with me. I am not good at that at all. And I think about the situations where I could be better. But anyway, I'm gonna take that.
Well, I would make the suggestion. One of the things that I've found more and more through my life, and particularly with my advocacy, is I never regret being polite and patient and kind to people, even people that make decisions that I don't like. I always benefit from being patient and understanding, and not and working through my anger and disappointment, but not to the face of the people that I'm going to need cooperation for to achieve what I want to achieve in future. Yeah. And even if people can't help me, I just generally find that if I am sharing and patient and helpful and kind to people, I never, ever regret it. For example, there was a parent at that actually organised a petition against the School Street pilot that we participated in several years ago. But I'm super proud that I've always been patient and kind with that person. And my kid actually hangs out with that person's kid now, and I can tell you that that it makes me very happy that that I have never been direct about my frustrations and thoughts about the way they conducted themselves early in our campaign.
I'm kidding. Oh my gosh. I don't look forward to those types of situations. I don't have any kids yet, so we'll see how that goes. But
yeah, it's a small community and you keep seeing the same people. It's always worth trying to be kind and patient and polite, even with people that you really massively disagree with.
100%. That's because you're not going to get anywhere when you go the full nuclear route. People shut down, they get defensive, and you don't get to have a good conversation. And that's why we're here, is to have a good conversation. And this has been a fantastic, well, it's been a one-sided conversation. I got to do a lot of listening. I look forward to listening back to it when I do the editing. But we're running out of time here. So at this point, can you just point the people's eyeballs anywhere you want them to look, or just plug away?
Well, look, I would like people to support Hub Cycling, who I have so much admiration for. Please look into joining your local Hub Cycling committee. I am definitely asking people to support Vision Zero Vancouver and its work. If you don't have a lot of time, one of the most effective things you can do is send an email or sign a petition, or especially sending an email before council makes a decision. That's a super useful thing, because advocates really need people to support their campaigns. You don't have to lead a campaign, but if you can contribute to a campaign, that's really helpful and really inspires advocates to keep going and keep working for people.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a absolute pleasure, and I've got a lot of value out of this myself, and I hope the listeners do as well. And hey, hopefully we don't have to have another conversation. We're gonna have to bring you back on for some disaster that's going on in city council. Hopefully we can
have a celebration next time.
Exactly. Fight the little fights to get those little improvements that you were talking about. So again, thank you so much for joining me, and everybody who's listening, thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.
Thank you.
The show is made possible by listeners like you. For access to early episodes, live shows, and other perks, join us on Patreon at Radio Free Urbanism.